Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there are a lot of so-called boutique pet foods on the market, and some of them may not be good for your pets. We're going to be talking about some possible links between dog food and heart disease with our regular guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Back with us, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. So, what questions do you have about pet food? What other health questions might you have about your pets? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email, maybe a photo of your pet as well, to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
So tell us about those links between food and heart disease in dogs.
Well, it's a little bit of a convoluted story, but it started back in July of 2018 when a group of veterinary cardiologists started seeing a number of dogs that don't usually have a heart disease, namely a disease called dilated cardiomyopathy, where the heart pumps very weakly and becomes blown up like a balloon and putting dogs into risk of heart failure. Although we do see it in certain breeds of dogs, it was just showing up more frequently. And one of the links that they found is that when they were doing a nutrition survey, which is what we do with every one of our patients, we always ask, what are you eating? The pet doesn't answer. Yeah. The owner does. And usually what they got back was that there were multiple diets that were implicated, but almost all of them were considered to be the grain-free diets, and that they had legumes or peas as one of the major ingredients. And so this started the FDA into looking at these diets, and they issued in August a warning that some of these diets may be associated with causing this type of heart disease in dogs. And these diets have been referred to as BEG diets, B-E-G diets. And what that stands for is boutique diets, exotic ingredients, and grain-free. And they're all kind of interconnected. And one of the things that, you know, I'm always concerned about is how much research is done on the manufacturing of the food. And when you're dealing with small boutique companies, they often don't have enough funding or expertise to be able to do the research that's necessary for good quality control. Meaning, are they researching the ingredients? Are they looking at, after it's made, you know, the nutrient contents and so on? Because what you put into the food may not be what you get out once it's been processed. The other thing are these exotic ingredients. And I just had an owner in the other day that had a dog that was being fed some type of bison. And I'm like, you know, the dog drinks out of the toilet and eats poop in the backyard. Why are you worried about having them eat an exotic ingredient like bison? And I think that owners are assuming that it may be better. But the big issue with these exotic ingredients is that we don't know how they interact with the other ingredients in the food. And part of the problem is that, you know, we end up having, you know, things like even an ingredient that's very common in the pet food world, like lamb. When you combine that with certain ingredients, the bioavailability of a specific amino acid called taurine that's very important for heart health tends to decrease. And so lamb-based diets often have to have extra taurine added in. So are these companies that are using elk and bison and ostrich and kangaroo and all these other oddball proteins actually looking at the bioavailability of ingredients that are combined with those particular foods? And then we've got the grain-free thing where to get the diet to hold together, they still have to put in some type of a carbohydrate. So they may contain things like sweet potatoes or legumes or peas and things, which are going to affect the basic amino acid makeup as well. And so what it comes down to is a whole bunch of foods have been implicated. And if you're feeding one of these diets, these boutique, exotic ingredient, grain-free diets, knowing that there is nothing in the research that says grain-free is better than dogs. Grains are an important part of the diet. It's rare to ever have a grain allergy, and they, once they're cooked, they're very digestible and add a source of protein and vitamins and minerals and fatty acids and so on, so they can be part of the diet. So what's an owner to do? Get off the diets. That's the easiest thing. Yeah. Pick a diet that is going to be one that you know is made by some of the bigger manufacturers that do the research, that have nutritionists on staff. If you don't want to change your diet, if you want to stay with one of these bag diets, I strongly recommend that you have a taurine level checked, which is a blood sample that gets sent to a lab. Usually we send them, I think, out to California. UC Davis is running them now in their amino acid lab. And supplement your dog if necessary. But I think it's easy just to get your dog off of one of these diets until we know more, because we still are, what is causing this? Is it the grain-free thing? Is it the exotic ingredients? Or is it just the lack of supervision in these small companies that are making these foods?
Yeah. Carmen emailed that her holistic vet says the issue is with taurine, and the way to get taurine in the diet is to add glandular meats. Heart, kidney, liver, and sardines.
Yeah. And, you know, the problem with that then is you're throwing the whole balance of the diet off, because now adding in all these other protein sources, what are you doing to the fatty acid balance? What are you doing to the vitamin mineral balance? And so by just adding in other things, it's not necessarily creating a balanced diet, and you may be creating other health problems for your pet. So the easiest way is to actually add taurine in, but I wouldn't do that unless your dog is actually taurine deficient, and that's where getting a sample drawn would be okay. I mean, it probably wouldn't hurt your dog to go on a taurine supplement. It's very, very safe to use, but we use it at various levels, kind of a supplement level, we've got a dog with low taurine levels, or we've got a dog that's actually got clinical heart disease. And I just had a dog in recently. It's actually one of our blood donor dogs, and it was one of the breeds that is more highly represented for having this type of problem. It was a golden retriever. Probably the two top breeds have been golden retrievers and cocker spaniels, at least in what I've been reading. And so we did taurine levels on this dog because he was on a grain-free diet that was one of the national companies, but they don't manufacture their own food. They have become a huge company in the pet food world, but still, you know, probably not doing the same surveillance that many of the other national companies are doing. And this dog was taurine deficient. We had them go to cardiology. They did a quick echocardiogram. Heart, thank goodness, was normal. Now he's on a taurine supplement, and we're going to be checking him again in a couple of months to kind of see where we're at after he's been supplemented. And obviously, we changed the dog's diet.
Let's take some calls. Michelle and Shano will give you a chance. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Sandy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just really wanted to reiterate what Dr. Sandy is saying. Definitely, if you are going to keep your dogs on a grain-free diet, get the taurine tested. Also, we had blood protein levels tested and an x-ray done and an echocardiogram done on one of our dogs after losing a dog who was on a grain-free diet. So if your dog does not need to be on a grain-free diet, please take them off.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing is either emailing, if you do find your dog is taurine deficient, it's important that the FDA get a hold of this information. And it's easy enough to file a report. You can either call them or send a message via email to them with the breed of your dog, what was found, and also what food and manufacturer you were feeding, since there's a lot of different flavors and, you know, types of food within one manufacturer. So that, again, that can be recorded. Right now, there's been at least 200 deaths. And, you know, probably many more dogs walking around with subclinical taurine levels that are out of whack. But I just think, you know, why feed something that is a fad? And just realizing that when you're feeding a grain-free diet to dogs, you're really just getting caught up in the commercial hype of something that is not a nutritionally sound practice.
And Michelle, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Mark in Elm Grove a chance to join us. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I had a question for the doctor. It doesn't have to do with diet, but this is a question. I'll give you the question first. It's a it's a quality of life issue versus a diagnosis and treatment issue for a 15-year-old Shih Tzu Maltese mix. He recently went to the veterinarian for a bladder issue. It turned out he had a bladder infection. But when they did the blood work, everything came back normal, but his alkaline phosphatase was greater than 1,000, which the vet said was indicative of Cushing's disease. And he said that we should probably have him worked up, which he described. It sounds like they give him a shot. He has to be there, and they draw at the vet's office. You draw blood every so often, et cetera. And then if it comes back positive for Cushing's, that there is medication that they can that we can give the dog, and then he's still going to need more workup to see if it's work, if it's effective, if dose has to be changed, etc. Now the dog is 15. He seems to have a good quality of life. He's walking. He is sort of hard of hearing, and at 15 he's stiffer. He's on Dasiquin, but he seems to have adapted. To whatever he has, if he does have Cushing's.
Yeah. You're really bringing up a really kind of involved but very important topic, and that's, you know, what to do with an older dog when you have a disease that is not necessarily going to be a fatal disease, that they can often live with for a long period of time. Cushing's disease is a disease of the adrenal glands, and for small breed dogs, the majority of them, it starts with a small benign tumor in the pituitary gland, which is in the brain. That's kind of the mastermind of all the endocrine system, and it tells the adrenal glands to produce too much hormone, namely cortisol. And the classic dog that comes in with Cushing's disease, like the textbook Cushing's disease dog, is drinking more water, urinating more, often having accidents in the house, maybe hungry all the time and wanting to eat more, losing hair, getting a pot belly, muscle wasting, may have an enlarged liver on palpation, and, you know, may have secondary skin infections. Sometimes we do see, as your dog had, urinary tract infections. It's because their immune system is suppressed because of all that cortisol going through their system. And there's a whole host of other things that we can see. But one of the biomarkers that will often lead us down the path of looking for a dog with Cushing's disease, besides if they come in looking like the dog I just described or sounding like it in history, is we will see this particular liver enzyme called alkaline phosphatase be elevated. And alkaline phosphatase is not specific for only this disease affecting the adrenal glands. It is a liver value that we can see elevated anytime the biliary system's involved, the bile tree system in the liver. So it's not totally specific for Cushing's disease. So we often have to look at what else is going on in the dog. And sometimes that involves looking at blood cell counts. Sometimes we'll see some changes there. But whether you treat or not, it all comes down to quality of life for the dog. For many, many old dogs, if you are not having a problem with them having accidents in the house, their blood pressure is doing okay because that's something else that can be affected with Cushing's disease. They are not eating you out of house and home and, you know, causing problems that way. Sometimes living with Cushing's disease in the final years of their life, it provides some relief because all that cortisol is probably making their joints feel better. You know, you've heard of the steroid high. When people get on prednisone, they often feel like they're really amped up. Well, that's kind of what these dogs are like as well. And sometimes they actually feel better while they're on it. So it's one of those things you really have to question because it's an expensive disease to treat. It's an expensive disease to diagnose. And it's an expensive disease to monitor. So those are all really good considerations. And, you know, I'd have to look at the whole package of your dog to be able to say, you know, is it something that you want to do? And we would probably sit down if you were in to see me and we'd go through all the pros and cons. There is an easier test that rules out Cushing's disease, but doesn't actually confirm that it is, but it tells you if your dog doesn't have Cushing's disease, and that's called a urine cortisol creatinine ratio. It's a urine test. You can catch a urine sample. Your veterinarian can submit it and have that test done. The problem is if it comes back positive, then you have to go through all of the Cushing's testing if you want to go down that path. So yeah. I think it's time to go back and talk to your veterinarian and express things just like you did with me is, you know, is it really worth doing because I'm not seeing any other symptoms in my dog? Or if you are, maybe it might be worth considering.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining in. You can email questions to us at ideas@wpr.org or phone them in at 1-800-642-1234. We've zeroed in a bit on dog food and heart disease, but taking some other questions as well. John and Boaz, we will give you a chance to join in now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I would like to talk about dental hygiene for dogs. And the wolf has been known to have 10,000 pounds per square inch crushing strength on his teeth, so they can eat bones. But I'm afraid that the dog food has an appetite enhancer like sugar that might take the enamel off of a dog's teeth, because an older dog needs teeth to crunch up the dog food.
Yeah. Well, if there is sugar in food, pet food, there are some foods that obviously have to have something, a sugar-based product in it, like some of the semi-moist foods that have that kind of squishy feel to it, that come usually with dry, in one of the, you know, kind of a combo type product. But the interesting thing about dogs is it's, and people even, is sugar isn't the culprit. It's the reaction of the sugars with bacteria in the mouth that is creating acids that cause caries or cavities. And we just don't see that in dogs. We do see cavities in rare occasions, and it tends to be more of a familial genetic type problem in dogs rather than something that is nutritionally related. Because, you know, dogs aren't brushing their teeth every day. Often we wish they did. We wish owners would do it every day. And yet we see periodontal disease as our big issue for dogs, meaning they get gum disease, a lot of tartar buildup, bacterial infections, loosening of the teeth. But rarely do we ever see cavities in dogs. And so I wouldn't really worry about sugars and that type of thing, although I don't think it's an ingredient that needs to be in food unless it's adding to the nutritional profile in some way, which I don't understand why. So, you know, what it comes down to is to maintain a dog's mouth so that they can eat crunchy foods. And I really have to say, don't give them bones. Don't give them anything that's hard enough that if you hit yourself with it, it would hurt. So natural bones, antlers, Nyla bones as one of the commercial things, those are hard enough that they can break teeth and actually cause slab fractures. So to maintain your dog's mouth so that they can continue to eat, we want to prevent periodontal disease. And that means brushing your pet's teeth, going in for regular dental cleanings through your veterinarian and evaluations, because it's really hard to tell what's going on with an awake dog or cat for that matter. And then, you know, really watch what you give your dog and what they are chewing on to help prevent dental fractures. And that will help prolong your dog's ability to enjoy life and have all their teeth in their mouth so they can continue to, you know, eat everything that they want to eat later in life.
John in Bangor emailed that he's been looking for a new food for his standard poodle because of the concerns with grain-free, and they're seeing huge differences in dry matter protein levels, anywhere from 20% to 45% in the high-end non-grain-free foods. Can you offer some guidelines here? He has a 2.5-year-old dog.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you're looking at not the label, because the ingredients label is very deceiving, and that is something that there's a lot of tricks that manufacturers can use to make certain products kind of stand out, using things that have more wet matter in it, like whole dressed chicken rather than chicken meal. And so actually looking at the nutritional profile and the AFCO feeding trial statement, which stands for the American Association of Feed Control Officials, is probably your best bet. So your nutritional adequacy statement and so on. And yes, you're right. There are different protein levels all across the board. And, you know, different ages of dogs have different protein needs. And I encourage you to go to the American Association of Veterinary Nutritionists website for some of the guidelines on that. There's also a very interesting, very good blog out there that has information on protein needs and myths and even the stuff that I was just talking about regarding taurine. And it's called Pet Foodology. And it's written by the Cummings Veterinary Medical Center nutritionist. And it's just got wonderful articles for owners and veterinarians and veterinary students and so on to be able to keep up to date on nutrition. So I do recommend that you go there. The problem with giving high protein dog foods is extra protein that's not used for rebuilding muscle, making things in the body to, you know, replenish what you need, is just peed out. And it's an expensive lawn fertilizer because that extra nitrogen is just urinated out. And so, you know, you want to stay with the protein that would be adequate for your dog to be able to support your dog's growth and development or reproducing needs, but you don't want to give too much. That extra stuff is not necessary. That whole, I'm not going to name companies, but, you know, that Hypro Glow that they used to call it, yeah. Is kind of a myth. And I think that we end up creating more problems for dogs feeding that, or for owners feeding that high protein food, because now you've got to patch your lawn up where the grass has died.
So take a look at Pet Foodology.
Pet Foodology, yes. It's a really good blog, and you can just Google that, and you'll get lots of great information on there.
And the other one you mentioned?
Well, the American Association of Veterinary Nutritionists.
Okay.
That's another place to go for information on pet foods. If you're looking at wanting to make your own pet food, if you're into doing your own cooking, you can get hooked up with veterinary nutritionists there. It's again a great site to go to. Mm-hmm. Rather than going to sites like one of the big pet food comparison sites that's out there is actually run by a human dentist and not a veterinary nutritionist. And that's what everyone goes to when it comes to like looking at pet food rankings. And I'm like, you know, did you realize that's a dentist that's running that site?
Diane in Madison emailed that, like other Springer Spaniel owners, she switched her dog to grain-free because he's been getting constant ear infections. She was amazed that the ear infections disappeared on that diet, grain-free. She buys a highly rated food that has salmon and sweet potato as primary ingredients, but have also used chicken and sweet potato. Any comments about grain-free reducing ear infections?
Well, most ear infections are present because the dog has some type of underlying skin condition, usually allergy related. And although food allergies are uncommon, I think they account for about 11% of the allergy cases that we see. Your dog truly may have had a food allergy, and it may have been to one of the top allergens, which are beef, chicken, dairy, you know, those kind of things are the more common ingredients. And so by switching to a different food that may not contain those, that may be why your dog's ears got better, because your dog did have a food allergy that was undiagnosed. The best way to diagnose food allergies, though, is to not just randomly grab foods over the counter, because often there's other proteins and sources of the irritating proteins in the food that you may not even be on the label because it's just been contaminated with it. But it's best to use a hydrolyzed protein diet and actually go through a proper feeding trial under the supervision of your veterinarian. And then if you want to do, you know, diet trials, say you can have a week where you add chicken in or beef in to see what is your dog actually allergic to? But again, it's rare to have grains be the offending ingredient. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It does happen, but it's rare. So for the majority of dogs, that would not hold true, that they would get better. But I'm glad your dog did. So, yeah.
Right. Susan emailed that her 11-year-old Boston has been allergic to chicken and beef all his life, going along with this. He's now on a fish and sweet potato grain-free dog food. She's very concerned hearing this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't had him checked, but he goes regularly and so far seems healthy. Her other concern is she has two other dogs that are on the same diet.
Get a taurine level checked. That's the easiest thing to do. You know, if you're worried, get that blood sample taken by your veterinarian and have it sent in. Or switch them to another diet that isn't grain-free. Those are your, you know, two big solutions. And the problem is we don't see them being ill, and it's, you know, we don't know just by looking at the dog. Yes, you may, if they're advanced, hear a heart murmur, hear a heart irregularity, see some signs of exercise intolerance, tiring when they're walking, coughing. But for many dogs, it's just comes back as the golden retriever that I was just mentioning, my latest patient that was taurine deficient. He had absolutely no symptoms. He just happened to be one of our blood donors and was eating that food. And I said, why don't we just double check? And sure enough, that's when we ran into troubles.
Jim in Camp Douglas, will give you a chance now. Thanks for waiting.
No problem. My dog's on fluoxetine for the past 3 months. I'm going to be boarding him for a week. I'm concerned that he may not get that daily dose of fluoxetine consistently when I'm gone. And I'm just wondering what might I be risking by him not being able to get that for a couple of doses or maybe even the duration of the boarding activity.
Well, the first thing I would recommend, if you have a concern that the boarding kennel isn't going to get in medication that your dog needs to be on, then find another boarding kennel. Because that's ridiculous. They should be able to get medication in. There's so many cool ways to get medication in now with little like soft squishy treats that you can hide the medication in, a spoonful of canned dog food. I would make sure that, you know, you take the medication in and, you know, really talk about the fact that your dog is on this medication. It takes about a month to build up to therapeutic levels. And so if your dog goes off of it for a week, you got to go back to square one again and start with that not an induction, but it's going to be, you know, you have to go right back to getting their levels of that medication back up in their system again. Fluoxetine is Prozac. It's used as an anti-anxiety drug. It's used for compulsive disorders and a lot of different things. And I think it's really important if your dog has a behavioral problem, especially that involves anxiety, that they not go off that medication and, you know, really bring it up to the kennel that it's important that your dog stay on this medication. And if they can't reliably do it, then you need a new boarding kennel.
Oh, Jim, thank you for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Mark in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Reference, 11-month-old yellow lab. At what age do I switch this dog from puppy chow to dog food? Second, UC Davis studies, at what age should I spay this dog? I'm told that we should wait a little longer than what we used to. Third question, do you breed a yellow lab to a brown lab? Wise idea or not?
All good questions. You know, regardless of whether you're of the age that you spay your dog at or not, we want to continue to feed a growth formula until your dog is fully grown, which for most dogs you're looking at, especially a large breed dog like a Labrador Retriever, till a year, a little bit past a year and a couple of months or so. For giant breed dogs, we may be looking at a year and a half to 2 years of age. So that would be, you know, something that even though they're spayed and that lowers their nutritional or their caloric needs because it lowers their metabolism, you'd still want to feed them that formula that provides them with all the ingredients and calcium and phosphorus and vitamins and everything for growth. It's not the ingredients that do it. It's all the makeup that those ingredients put into the diet. I pulled one of those that I shouldn't have said that because ingredients aren't important. It's all the final product when you get it out. And then your question as to what age to do the spay and neuter, this is a very controversial thing in the veterinary world. For large breed male dogs, I think it's a no-brainer. If you can wait and be, one, a responsible owner and not let your dog indiscriminately roam and breed, and you're not having any male-related behavior problems, then waiting till they're over a year of age just improves their risk of skeletal problems, and there's a number of associated things, but mainly like joint issues that are associated with growth. With female dogs, it's a little bit more of an issue because if they, every time they have a heat cycle, it increases their risk of breast cancer. And so you have to weigh out the risk of, boy, I've got to live with my dog going through a heat cycle, and every heat cycle they have, it increases their risk of breast cancer. If I delay spaying and neutering, they may have better joint development, but, you know, I have these other things to consider. So there's a lot to consider for female dogs, and I don't have the right answer for you, but that would be something to kind of look at the pros and cons with your veterinarian to try to determine what would be best for you and your dog. The early age spay neuter, I mean, if it's an animal that is going out, like a shelter animal, something like that, where we want to make sure that they are not going out and reproducing and adding to the problem, an irresponsible owner, obviously, you know, getting them done early is well worth it, and we need to have that done before they get placed out in public. Your question about breeding yellow labs and chocolate labs together, it is interesting because one of the things I want to talk about today is just, you know, is chocolate bad for the Labrador Retriever? I know that's kind of, you know, I'm not talking about the candy. I'm talking about just chocolate, the color of the dog. The Labrador Retrievers come in black, yellow, and chocolate. And chocolate is actually a recessive color. To be able to have chocolate labs made, both the parents have to have at least one of their genes for the recessive chocolate. So you may have a black dog that's recessive for chocolate and a yellow lab that's recessive for chocolate, and you put them together and you could have a whole combination in the litter. But if you have, you want only chocolate labs, you've got to breed chocolate to chocolate. And so this ends up creating kind of a smaller genetic pool. And the Royal College of Veterinary Medicine over in the UK did a study looking at 33,000 Labrador Retrievers, all different colors. And what they ended up finding is that and they don't know why, there's still more research to do on this, but that the chocolate labs, and it's probably because they're recessive and a smaller genetic pool, but died earlier, up almost 2 years earlier, less life expectancy than yellow or black labs. And for all different reasons, but we found that they didn't live as long. They also had higher incidence of skin issues, ear problems, skin infections, allergies, which is very common in the lab anyways, but even more common in the chocolate. So it just comes down to, you know, you're dealing with this recessive gene, and, you know, is it something that you want to be doing, knowing this information? And I love chocolate labs, but I think you have to go into it knowing the genetics behind it. And that gets me into the whole thing about the silver labs that are out there now too, which is another just a recessive gene that's showing up in the breed. And people are paying big money for silver Labrador Retrievers, which are basically a chocolate lab with a diluting gene. And they turn out to be this silver color. And when we start seeing these dogs, they are associated with not only the same thing that chocolate labs have, decreased life expectancy and so on, but we also can see some issues with their skin developing this color dilution alopecia, where they start losing hair and having issues. Not all of them have that, but it is something that we'll see. And we'll also see this in like blue Dobermans and any of the other dogs that have these color mutant deficiencies. So kind of interesting question. Thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. Mark. Appreciate the call. Well, Laura in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I guess I've got a couple questions. Now, taurine is an amino acid that's found in animal meat proteins. So why is it putting grain back into the diet is helpful?
That's a really good question, and it may be because instead of putting grains in, other things are used, like legumes and peas, as a source of protein and carbohydrates as well to help hold it together. We don't know exactly what is causing this. We don't know whether it's the manufacturing where exotic ingredients are being used that in combination with other things end up causing amino acid deficiencies, the type of processing, the combination of ingredients, the ingredients themselves. It's one of those things where we just know that these boutique exotic ingredient and grain-free diets are the ones that seem to be implicated. And just going ahead and adding meat to the diet is going to throw off the balance for your dog. It's going to raise the protein level, raise the fat level, change the vitamin level, change calcium and mineral level. And so it's better to start with a balanced diet rather than just trying to fix something that may have an issue.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Laura. Let's go to Mary in Altoona next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I have a couple questions. Do you want me to lump them all together?
Sure.
Okay, my 11-year-old dog has a gunky discharge coming out of his eyes. It's not a ton. And also the white around his eyes are red. And also, do I have to do the fecal parasite exam if I do the HeartGuard from May 1st to November 1st? And if I'm doing the Lyme vaccination, do I also have to do that Lyme, Echinus, and a heartworm test as well?
Whoa, we've got lots of questions here. Okay, so you're using heartworm, you said, from May through November, heartworm prevention, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
National guidelines are to use it year-round, regardless of where you live, because we have various seasonality, and you're right in that heartworm preventatives are more than just heartworm preventatives. They also control intestinal parasites. Not all of them. And it really depends on which one, a heartworm preventative you're using, which parasites your dog may get. So things like the ivermectin pyrantel combinations, which are Tri-Heart, Iverheart Plus, HeartGuard Plus, will control roundworms and hookworms, but may not get whipworms, which could be a big problem for your dogs. We still advocate getting fecal exams done because of human health risk, your dog's health. And so regardless of whether your dog's on heartworm preventative, we should be still checking a stool sample at least annually. And in some cases, if they're going to be in places where lots of dogs are congregating, like doggy daycare, many doggy daycares require it a couple of times a year to make sure that the dog is negative for any parasites that could be transmitted to other dogs. So good question, but it's going to depend on kind of your lifestyle of your dog and what heartworm preventative they're on, and knowing that not every heartworm preventative gets every parasite that's out there. And so we still look for things. So yes, getting that fecal test done, but having your dog on heartworm preventative year-round is really important, especially if you travel a little bit. Even just going into central Illinois is enough to change the heartworm prevalence of where your dog is going. Your question regarding Lyme vaccine and whether you need to have your dog tested or not, the test that we typically do is that many veterinarians do, that is a multiple disease screening test, is called the 4DX test. And it's looking at heartworm, Lyme disease, anaplasma, and Ehrlichia. Heartworm is one of the tests, and that's very important to be screening for that periodically to make sure that we haven't had your dog miss a pill, breakthrough such as you using your medications only seasonally. That's, you know, one of those things that we like to screen, because heartworm is one of those diseases that even after treatment can leave permanent heart and blood vessel damage for your dog and lung damage. Lyme vaccine is not 100% effective, and so still screening for Lyme disease is important. And then Lyme vaccine is not going to prevent your dog from getting these other tick-borne diseases as well, like anaplasma or Ehrlichia. So we like to screen for those so that we know what to be watching for, and to encourage you to be using year-round tick control as well. Regarding your dog with its eye disease, that needs to be evaluated. Your dog could have anything from, as maybe you were thinking, allergies potentially, but usually there's other symptoms with allergies, itchy ears, itchy feet. They may have some other skin areas on their body that are affected. But I'd be looking to make sure that your dog has appropriate tear production, does not have a bacterial eye infection that needs to be treated, because sometimes we will see that going beyond the eye into the skin around the eye. So that needs to be evaluated and treated appropriately, whether that's being, you know, handling allergies or treating a bacterial infection or treating for dry eye if your dog isn't making enough tears. So all good questions. I hope I answered all your questions, but keep up with that testing and your year-round flea and tick and heartworm treatment.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining in. We have many callers still online, so we'll go back to the phones. And Ryan in Tomahawk up next. Ryan, hello.
Hello. I just had a question kind of going back to the grain aspect of what kind of got it started with why it was, you know, the idea of taking it out of the food and what were the supposed benefits of it, I guess. I don't know if you guys talked about it or if I missed it, but I just didn't know where that was coming from, because I feed my dog Blue Buffalo and I think it's, I don't know if it's corn-free or grain-free, and I guess I was just wondering. I thought it was, you know, there's benefits to the fact of not, you know, giving that to them. And you guys never really talked about it. I didn't hear it. So I was just curious if you had anything to add to on that.
Well, you have definitely fallen for the myth. Mm-hmm. sorry to say that, but there is zero proof that grain-free is better. Absolutely none in the veterinary nutritional world, except for those very uncommon dogs that have grain allergies, and those are rare and they have to be looked for by going through an elimination diet trial and then seeing if adding grains in makes a difference for the dog's ability to be comfortable. Your question as to why it happened, the theory is, there's a couple of theories. One of them is about the time that grain-free diets came out for pets is about the time that gluten-free diets came out for people. And just how many people do you know that actually have a gluten intolerance or have celiac disease, yet still, you know, we've got all these gluten-free items on the market. So again, it's one of those things that it just becomes, you know, part of the culture. And I think one of my theories and other veterinary nutritionists is that companies were looking at how they can make themselves stand out compared to other companies. And instead of what can we put in our food, what can we not put in our food became the motto. And that, I think, is what started most of this. So it has become just one of these things where for the last 10 years, this has become popular. And yet there is no nutritional basis for it when it comes to pet food. If your dog is doing well on that particular diet, does not have any indication of any health problems, and you've gone into your veterinarian and there's no evidence of heart disease, and you know you're happy with it and you're willing to pay extra for it, and you're willing to know that certain companies don't manufacture their own food. They have other companies do it for them, so they may not have the same surveillance because they're not actually making their own. Or you're dealing with a company that may be spending more on advertising than they do on product development. I'd say stay with the food that you're feeding if you're happy with it. But just, you know, it's consumer beware when it comes to pet food, and you need to, you know, really do your homework. And I like to have owners work with companies that actually have veterinarians on staff and that are veterinary nutritionists that, you know, make their own diets, that do a lot of product surveillance and actually do research into nutrition too. So, and it does take some work to be able to find a food that would be appropriate for your dog. But just know that that grain-free is not necessary unless your dog actually has a grain allergy.
Now, should Ryan have his dog tested for taurine levels?
He can if he wants to. But I think the big thing is when you go in for your physical exam, make sure that you tell your veterinarian what you're feeding. And if you're worried, that's a very easy thing to do. But doing a thorough physical exam, I mean, it's always kind of after the fact if you've already diagnosed your dog with heart disease, because they don't always all get better. And even with therapy, I think that it's important to, you know, just make sure that that's a flag on your pet's record, that what they're feeding, so that it's something that can be monitored.
There you go, Ryan. Thank you so much for calling. I want to give Ed in Middleton a chance to join in. Ed, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Yes, we've got a, she weighs about 75 pounds. She's 3 years old. And she's really, we really like her and everything, but she does. She's been naughty. She's been pooping on the floor, and she's been chewing up some of this. Like my son's cap got chewed up, and we're wondering if we can. We want to keep her.
Well, I think one of the first things is get out of your mind that she's naughty, that she's doing this to make you angry or to get back at you for something. Most dogs that have behavior issues, especially if they've been previously housebroken and well-trained to only chew on the things that are appropriate for them, and things like this change, is because they have some type of an anxiety-based disorder, whether that be separation anxiety, noise phobias, something that could be triggering this. And I think it's really important that you get involved with an applied animal behaviorist or a veterinary behaviorist to be able to get to the bottom of finding out what's the trigger for your dog's problem. Don't punish your dog. You know, really feel sorry for them when they're doing this. You know, if it's after the fact and you walk in and they've defecated on the floor, you're just making their anxiety worse by punishing them, yelling at them, doing anything like that. Get some help for your dog. And I don't know what's triggering this for your dog, but this would be something that going through a you know, very lengthy behavior evaluation, maybe even having someone coming to your house to be able to see your dog in its living environment, videotaping your dog when you leave it to just see kind of what level of anxiety your dog is at. Those would all be very, very helpful things to try to help your dog. And there is help out there. Don't worry that you can't do anything for them. We want this dog to lead a long, healthy, normal life. And just 3 years old, she's got a long life ahead of her. So
yeah,
get some help.
For sure. Good luck, Ed. So an applied animal behaviorist.
Definitely.
Yeah. Alicia in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn.
Good afternoon, Larry and Dr. Sandy. Yes, I'm interested in hearing about the food and the grain removal for kitty cats, for those of us that keep kitties.
Yeah.
Well, if you could address that and also repeat the American Veterinary Nutritional website for me.
It's the American Association of Veterinary Nutritionists. It's the website.
Okay.
And what, with cats, they do have a big issue with taurine deficiency, not so much with the diets that they're on, but, with grain-free diet, because cats are carnivores. They require animal protein, because they can't make taurine on their own. And so, most manufacturers now are making sure that they surveilling the food for taurine levels while it's being made, after it's been made. Looking at, there was a study done that was looking at different pet foods that and taurine levels in the pet food. And they found that, again, some of these boutique-y pet foods where it's like smaller manufacturers that probably don't do the after manufacture nutritional evaluation, about 15% of them, I think, ended up having some nutritional deficiency in the diet. So, again, staying with one of the big manufacturers is probably helpful for your cat. But with cats being carnivores, they don't necessarily benefit from grains. Grains won't hurt them because they become part of the diet. And if they are cooked appropriately and it's a well-balanced food, it can be part of the cat's diet. But again, cats being carnivores, the need for carbohydrates and things is definitely lower. And so it does make sense for cats to be on a high protein, low grain diet. But again, it needs to be well balanced and make sure that it has all the appropriate nutrients in there. Just because it's grain free doesn't mean that it's necessarily well balanced for your cat.
There you go, Alicia. Thank you for calling. Carla in Mauston, your turn. Hi, Carla.
Hi. My question is, we've been feeding a product that is grain free. And I called the company about it, and it does have, I believe it's meat byproducts. It does have peas and some type of potato. But I asked them if it had terrine in it, and she said that it was in the meat product itself.
Right. Now, and is that- yeah, and that's where taurine comes from, is from the animal products that are being made. But sometimes they do have to add extra taurine to the food, and you may see that on the label, but it comes down to it is part of the animal protein, so it may not be actually on the label. But you know, again, have they done the post manufacturing looking at the food to make sure that the heat processing has not damaged the taurine, and that the combination of ingredients that they've has not made the taurine in the protein non-bioavailable? And those are all things that when you use some of these exotic ingredients or are using things like legumes or peas as part of the protein source, where you may be getting some taurine deficiency.
There you go, Carla. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we finally have some open lines again, so you can join in. I haven't given the phone number in a long, long time. We're going to be taking a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. But you can call in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org, and send a photo of your pet along, too, if you want to do that when you email us in. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online right now, so we'll go back to the phones. Let's go to Ella in Appleton next. Ella, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just curious, because we had talked about, or I had heard you guys talk about brushing dogs' teeth and everything to prevent periodontal disease, and I give my dog dental bones, like from Purina, and I was just wondering if there's actually a rhyme and reason to it, or if I'm just wasting my money on a product that tastes good for my pet.
Oh, what a good question. I do the same thing with my pets every day as well, but with that said, brushing is still probably the best thing that you can do to be able to help prevent periodontal disease in your pet. Obviously, if your pet has underlying dental disease, chewing on something or putting a toothbrush in the mouth is not in their pet best interest, because it's going to be painful for them. So you want to start doing all of this after you've already been in and had your pet's mouth evaluated and any disease treated and everything's healed up, and then you can go back to helping to prevent things from happening. A really good website to go to look at what has got the veterinary dentist seal of approval as to whether it actually works or not, because there's a boatload of dental things out there for pets, is the Veterinary Oral Health Council's website, vohc.org. It's a website that has on there, both for cats and dogs, listings of everything from dental treats and chews and diets to rinses and toothpaste and other additives and things that you could try, and whether they control tartar, plaque and tartar, or just plaque. And the ones by Nestle Purina, the dental chews that they make that are available in the grocery store, are one that have the VOHC seal of approval. So is it going to totally make your dog never have to have a dental again? Obviously not. I mean, we brush our teeth every day, we floss, we still go to the dentist and they find tartar. And so I think it's important to realize that it helps to keep things under control on days that you can't brush, or, you know, if you have a dog that's resistant to brushing, it's helping, but you still need those professional cleanings periodically according to what your veterinarian finds when you go in for your annual exam. But the diets are helpful as well, and that would be something you would feed every day. Things like Oral Care by Science Diet, TD is another one. Royal Canin makes a dental diet as well. Lots of different things out there to be able to try. Probably the downside with using dental treats is they do add a significant calorie load to your dog. And so when you're using those, they do have to be looked at from that point of view. And you either have to cut back a little bit on the food you're feeding or increase the amount of exercise your dog's getting so they don't get overweight while you're trying to prevent dental disease.
Now, when it comes to cats.
Yes.
I've had some good luck with Greenies.
Greenies, yeah. And that is one on the cat list that has the seal of approval as well. They are a green, very large, crunchy cat treat. And in fact, I just saw your cat last week. I shouldn't be revealing client confidential information, but you brought it up, Larry.
Yeah, please do.
And I was really impressed because Larry has two senior cats over 10, and the mouth is absolutely beautiful. I mean, spotless teeth, no gingivitis. And I'm like, how do you do it? He goes, Greenies. And I was like, perfect. So we have incorporated those into the cat's diet. And we're, you know, I just said, stay with them because they help. But you have to use, what do you use, about six to eight a day?
A little higher.
Oh, okay. But they're only a couple of calories each. Yeah. I think, you know, so they're pretty low in calories. So if you did give like 10 a day, that would be 20 calories, which would probably account for 10% of your cat's daily intake. Yeah. So I think that's a really good trade-off. So yeah, using those helps prevent you from having to go in and see the veterinary dentist.
Let's take another call. Bill in Black River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Larry and Sandy. Okay, we got a Maltese toy poodle mix, weighs about 10 pounds, and he has very strange eating habits. I put out a plate full of these little pedigree crunchies every day, and he'll go on a binge. You let him sit for 2 days, and then maybe the third day he'll eat some. We give him boiled chicken, and he pecks away at that off and on, not much at a time. But every night about 6 o'clock, he sits in front of the cabinet where the rawhide bones are stored, and he sits there and whines. And so we give him one of those, and they're really hard. And he goes at them so hard that he'll stop, and he's panting.
Oh, my goodness.
And he'll eat about half of one, and he chews them good, but they soften up as he chews them. And he gets one of those, half of one at least every night. And he loves these little oranges, these cuties, and he'll eat a whole one of them. But otherwise, he's just really strange. Are those bones okay for him?
Well, rawhide in general, you have to be careful. You want to make sure that it's manufactured in the United States and not outside the country where there may be less surveillance, bleaching agents and things used that could be problematic for your dog. They need to be sized appropriately for your dog. You need to make sure that your dog is eating normal food and not just eating those, because they're a treat and they're a really good treat, as you are finding out with your dog, and they're not well balanced. We do see sometimes dogs choking on them, so you need to be able to get them away from your dog if there's a problem. And then you've got the issue of, whatever's on the outside of the animal that made those rawhide is on the rawhide. And so you could have E. coli and salmonella and things. So I don't like using them in homes with young children or anyone that is immunocompromised, perhaps someone going through chemotherapy, that type of thing. So you have to really, it's a consumer beware when you're using any of the rawhide. And even some of the rawhide, like the compressed rawhide, is hard enough that it can break teeth. But back to issue with your dog and eating, it sounds like you have created a monster, a very fussy dog that's holding out for the goodies, the sweet oranges, the chicken that's unbalanced. And it's going to take some time, but I would really work on trying to get your dog on a balanced diet. And even if it is using something like maybe a canned food diet that isn't the best for the teeth, but then if you start incorporating things like using a rawhide or toothbrushing, then that may help keep your dog's mouth under control. But at least your dog is getting a balanced diet rather than, you know, just periodically picking at a little bit of canned food. So, yeah, back to your question, rawhide, yes, use it. But the rest of your diet, the dog's diet, really needs to be investigated. And I'd be working with you to try to get something, if I was your veterinarian, into the dog that's well-balanced.
There you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Evie in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Evie.
Hi. Background first, my husband and I are both nurses, so we're very much realists in the way we look at things. Our 9-year-old Westie was diagnosed with transitional cell bladder cancer in November via, our first complaint was a bladder infection. And we followed up with ultrasounds. We had an evaluation at a regional veterinarian. The tumor is not blocking her ureters, at least not yet. It's at the top of the bladder, so her urethra is free as well. We chose to treat her with daily meloxicam. We've had one ultrasound, and the tumor has actually shrunken a little bit. And behavior-wise, you would never know that anything is wrong with this girl. I'm just wondering if you could share some thoughts on that. I know the prognosis. Just curious.
Yeah.
For your thoughts.
Yeah. It's you know, transitional cell carcinoma in dogs is one of these interesting things because we know that there's a high genetic predisposition in certain breeds of dogs, such as like the Scottie. It's like 20 times the rate of it developing in other breeds of dogs. And in Westies, it's about anywhere, I don't know, like 5%, 2 to 5%, I think I've read, higher than the general population as well. So you've got one of the breeds that's in like the top five or six dog type breeds of dogs that get this particular type of bladder cancer. But we also know that there's an environmental component as well. Pesticides are probably one of the big things that we look into, and different insecticides that may be used in the environment have been implicated. In humans, smoking is probably the big risk factor for developing TCC. And so then the question comes into play, what about pets living in a home with somebody that's smoking? Is that potentially leading to it? And I don't know, because we don't have any research that I know of on that. But, you know, it sounds like your veterinarian's right on track. When you get a dog in that has blood in the urine and you culture it and you find they don't have anything there that's growing, there's no infection, why are they having blood? You start looking, you get x-rays and abdominal ultrasound done, maybe even just looking at the urine sample. I have a beagle that I'm working with that has sheets of these cells called transitional cells that are the lining cells of the bladder that become cancerous, that's coming in for an ultrasound because he's got blood in his urine and he's in the top five for having bladder cancer. And so we're looking at whether he's got this as an issue or not. Treatment-wise, if surgery is possible, then that would be something that you'd want to be looking into. And it sounds like your dog's, where the location of this is, would be possible because it's not involving the ureters or the exit point of the bladder. And if it was, then that becomes an issue where you just can't have a dog that doesn't have a bladder. But using a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, typically I would pick a drug called piroxicam, but meloxicam is very close, and that has some anti-cancer type effects as well. There's other chemotherapy agents that can be used, and I'd have to refer to my oncology colleagues to be able to find out what can be used. But as long as your dog is comfortable and happy, enjoy every day you have with them, because this is a cancer that is going to spread and eventually going to start causing problems with them having difficulty eliminating urine. And then you're going to have to make some tough decisions. But how long that will be is dependent on how – I know. Who knows? The severity of the cancer, location, and whether the meloxicam you're using is really helping and doing something. Good luck.
Yeah, good luck, Evie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Cindy in Juneau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We have two dogs and a cat. The big dog, he's a pointer mix, and he has always got yeast in his ears. Right now he's on steroids and an antibiotic because they also found bacteria in his ears. But I'm wondering if there's something we can do to stop that yeast growth. We've had him on limited ingredient diets. We've changed his treats, and he gets chicken and sweet potato treats, and the yeast just keeps coming back. About 2 weeks after his antibiotic and steroid treatments, the yeast will be back again. We don't know what to do to stop this.
the likelihood is that the yeast is probably there because the ears are warm and moist. And the reason why the ears are warm and moist is that your dog probably has something wrong with its skin barrier and probably has some underlying allergic skin disease. So that's like the whole answer is there's something wrong with the barrier there that's creating this. Yeast are a normal inhabitant of the ear in small numbers, but when they overgrow, there's usually some underlying reason for it. Changing the diet, unless your dog has a food allergy, is probably not going to make any difference. Adding in something to the diet is probably not going to make any difference. And what it may come down to is if we have a dog that we suspect has some type of an allergic skin issue, using periodic steroid ear drops rather than systemic steroids that affect the whole body, treating the ears topically. There are some topical antifungal ear washes that are very effective that you can get from your veterinarian as well. And so often I will use an ear wash that has an antifungal agent in it. And then I will often have the dog on a steroid ear drop as well to take the inflammation down so the ear is less warm and moist so that the yeast don't like to grow. And often that will get it under control. But it comes down to just trying to say, can we cure this dog from this? You don't cure allergies, you control them. And so looking at this being a kind of lifetime problem that you're going to have to maintain with routine care and maintenance all the time and not just treat and forget about it and then have it flare up again. That's kind of all I have to say about chronic yeast. It's common and you just need to stay on top of it all the time.
And Cindy, you were wondering about feeding your cat tuna sometimes.
Loves tuna. She does not like the canned foods. She does not like wet food at all. So she usually gets like a Friskies, I believe it is, indoor formula. Mm-hmm. But as soon as my husband mixes a little bit of mayonnaise with tuna, boy, she's all over that.
Okay.
Is that something that she can eat regularly and along with the dry food, or should we kind of steer clear of that?
Yeah, regular human tuna is not going to be, have the right levels of antioxidants and different things in it. And so we can start seeing some vitamin deficiencies when cats are only eating that. And you can create a cat that becomes addicted to only eating human tuna and then totally unbalanced diet. So what I would be recommending is if your cat is normal weight and will eat its other food regularly without any trouble, potentially using a little tuna as a treat. I mean, as long as 90% of their diet is well-balanced and they're willing to eat it, I'd say go for it. A little bit once in a while, not going to make a difference, but just don't let it be an everyday, this is my main part of my diet type thing, because that's where you're going to run into troubles.
There you go, Cindy. Thank you so much. Patricia in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. My question is also about a cat. I adopted a cat from the Humane Society a year ago. She's three. The only thing she's ever eaten since I have had her is dry Purina cat chow, which I put in her dish in the morning, and that's it. It's there all day. She nibbles now and then. She never totally empties 1.5 cups. And I think she's too thin. And what else should I be giving her?
So, first of all, when we look at cats' body condition scores, many people who think their cats are too thin, they actually have a cat that's overweight. So what does your veterinarian feel about your cat's body condition?
You know, I have not taken her to the vet. I'm handicapped, and getting her there is a problem. I took her there from the shelter, and she passed with flying colors. And she has not been back since then.
Yeah, you may want to look at getting even a house call vet to come, because you need to keep your cat up to date on rabies vaccination for meeting local ordinance requirements. And if you're concerned about your cat's weight, they can let you know whether your cat is ideal body condition or not. First of all, 1.5 cups of food a day is a lot of food. Knowing that most cats that are spayed or neutered need maybe about 200 calories a day, and that most foods are going to have 350, depending on the level of food, up to 450 calories per cup. A half a cup a day is typically adequate for majority of cats. So your cat may be getting everything it needs. But this is where having your kitty evaluated, and to find out if there is a local house call veterinarian that can come and help you with your cat. Because I really think that if it's been a couple of years since they've been looked at, since you've adopted her, it's time to have her looked at so that your questions can be answered. And nutrition is one of those things that we incorporate into our wellness program. It's a big part of it. So we spend a lot of time looking at your cat's body condition and what you're feeding, and be able to help you with coming up with the right number of calories and the correct formulation to be able to help your cat maintain a healthy life.
There you go, Patricia. Thank you for calling. And Rebecca in Madison, your turn. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Our cat has inflammatory bowel disease for a couple of years. And she's taking some prednisone to help control it. And I'm just wondering what causes that, and is there something else we can do besides medication?
Yeah, but when we see inflammatory bowel disease in cats, often we think that there may be some type of a dietary hypersensitivity. So one of the things that we will do for these cats is, besides seeing if steroids help them, and long-term use of that obviously has consequences, we would be looking at putting them on a hydrolyzed protein diet. There's several on the market. One is made by Royal Canin. Nestle Purina makes one. Hill's makes one. So there's a number out there that you could get your veterinarian to get you some samples so that you can see which one your cat likes the best. And that's usually for long-term management what we have to do for these cats. One of the other things that we get concerned about is sometimes cats will have gastrointestinal lymphoma, which is actually a type of cancer that can respond to prednisone. And so when we get that response, is it because your cat has inflammatory disease, or do they actually have intestinal cancer? And so getting biopsies done, either via scoping or surgical biopsies, really helps with knowing exactly what is going on with your cat. I don't know if that's been done or not to be able to get the diagnosis, but if that hasn't been done, that might be something to be looking into. But I think minimum would be a diet change to a hydrolyzed protein diet.
Just about out of time, but Linda wonders if there's a relationship, her dog eats dirt, any relationship in a dietary lack of vitamins, minerals?
Not typically dogs just like dirt. They may be going after, you know, mice and things like that that are in the ground. So, you know, just change their focus, throw a ball, do something to keep them from eating it, because they can get parasites from ingesting dirt.
Oh, there we go. On that note, we are out of time. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're back April 23rd. We'll do this all over again. In the meantime, just a reminder, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her come by, and she'll be back April 23rd. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and then at 11:45, take a look at Wisconsin Caves. There's a book out on caves. That's going to be a lot of fun. So I hope you can join us for that. But you know what? In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.